But then there are the comets, bright and racing past. Everyone takes notice, even if they do not last. It's what people remember. They're a dramatic, burning light that stands out on the landscape and brightens up the night.
A salute to the One Slam Wonders. Yes, today we're going to be looking at those players who have climbed the top of the mountain once and never again. Now, Buzz, before we get into this, I just want to unpack the term One Slam Wonder, which I think by its nature is almost derogatory. People who are referred to as a One Slam Wonder are almost subtly derided. They were only good enough to win one Grand Slam. It's an injustice, that term. Instead of deriding the achievement, we should be celebrating it more.
It really harks back to another term, which is one hit wonder.
Yes.
And that is a musical term. So you think of someone like The Knack with My Sharona, for example. The inference is they were good enough to write one good song, but they weren't quite at the level to continue it.
And the millions and millions of others who weren't good enough to write one good song?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because to win a Grand Slam is no mean feat. To win seven matches in a row against an open opposition, the best in the world, you have to hit the heights of tennis. And if you've won one, you enter very rarefied atmosphere.
But sometimes it almost becomes like a millstone around the neck of a player. Well, you did it once. What's stopping you from doing it again? And maybe there is just one in them. I'm sure in years to come, with medical advances, they'll be able to, at birth, run a scanner over you, and they'll be able to say, there's one slam in this kid, there's six in that one. But for now, I think we just take what we can get and congratulate them.
That opens up a whole lot of moral questions as to the parents adopting out that child. One slam, I'm sorry, this kid's got six.
We had expected so much more.
So much more.
With our genes.
Imagine if Richard Williams had done that scan.
What about Steffi Graf and Andre Agassi? They get that scan done and the kid's got no slams in them.
It's like, well, how did that happen?
Accusations would start flying thick and fast.
Genetics, my hat.
Who's the father here?
Exactly. So, it begs a question, really. In the history of tennis, how many of the Grand Slam winners have just won the one?
Mm.
And I can give you a figure here. And this is for the totality of tennis. This isn't the Open era since 1968. This is all of tennis from the beginning of each slam. So for men, for example, there's 149 male Grand Slam winners. So the next player to win his first slam will be number 150. And of those 149, there are 64 one slam wonders, and that's 43%.
Mm.
With the women, there's only been 120 Grand Slam winners. And of those, 47 have been one slam wonders. That's 40%. Very similar. We're looking at around about the 40% mark of all Grand Slam winners are one slam wonders.
Okay. Well, those numbers are certainly fascinating, Buzz. And we're going to unpack a little further and look at the types of one slam wonders. Those who had the tournaments of their lives, peaked once and essentially were done. Those that won only one, but boy, should have won more.
For various reasons.
Various reasons. So we'll drill into that and also look at some special cases.
But before we do, I've got a teaser question, Remo, that we'll answer at the end of the podcast. So for our listeners out there, here's a question for you. Which Grand Slam of the four Grand Slams, we're talking the Australian Open, French, Wimbledon and US Open, which of those Grand Slams has produced the most solo winners, the most one slam wonders in the Open era? And we'll answer that at the end of the podcast.
I was just happy so much for myself, but also for all the people who helped me along the way. And that's why I ran up there to the box and say hi to everybody and thank them so much for helping me.
Marion Bartoli, Wimbledon champion. How does that sound?
Honestly, I just can't believe it's still, You have to forgive me if I'm doing some English mistakes. I'm French at the end of the day, so. But, you know, as a little girl, I dreamed about this moment for so long, and I was there in 2007, and I missed it, and I know how it feels, Sabine, and I'm sure, believe me, you will be there one more time. I have no doubt about it.
Buzz, let's look at now some of the players who have made multiple finals before winning their one Grand Slam. There's a whole raft of issues here that present that are worth having a discussion about. The sense of growing pressure, the more finals you lose, does it become harder to win that final, or does having gone through a sequence of finals where you've lost, does it teach you what you need to do?
You'd think that once you've been through them, the newness of it wouldn't get you. You wouldn't freeze because you're suddenly out in centre court in front of all these people in a final. You've been there before. On the other hand, there must be the thought that goes through your head, what if I don't win?
Yeah, so it really comes down to the player and how they address those issues or if they become an issue in the first place.
Another way of seeing that also is that if they've lost a previous final because they were a bit tired, a bit nervous, there might be sometimes just a way they go out there with added purpose, but also relaxed at the same time to say, well, look, I can do this because I've been here before and there's no point getting nervous. What's the profit in it? I think it's a very fine psychological edge they're walking in that one.
Do you think there would be any scope for perhaps the ATP and the WTP setting up some kind of therapy group where players who have lost multiple slams come together round the table and swap stories?
Like, you know, have to stand up and say, you know, I'm Jack Crump. I've lost 4 Australian Open finals.
That's right.
And I'm a loser.
I'm a loser. And someone else stands up, tells their story.
Yeah.
What happened to you, Jack?
It has to be a safe space.
Yeah.
I think for all of them. Because there's a lot of emotion flying around. Of course, their coaches would be in the background on chairs.
I was going to ask you, do you think the coaches who were coaching them when they lost the final should be in attendance?
Do you think they should be in the circle or they should be in a box above the circle?
Should they have their own therapy group? Coaches who have coached players who have lost multiple Grand Slams.
Hell of an acronym.
It is.
Let's have a look at some of these players, why don't we, Remo?
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with Goran Ivanišević, famous example.
Very famous.
Now, he won Wimbledon in 2001. He beat Pat Rafter in an amazing final.
Very memorable.
It was almost like a Davis Cup match because there were so many Croatians in the crowd and Australians in the crowd. It had that real buzz about it.
Yeah.
Went to 5 sets. Ivanišević finally won.
Yeah.
How many slam finals had he been in before that?
Well, he'd lost 3 Wimbledon finals before that. I don't believe he'd been in any others.
No, I don't. I think he was primarily grass court.
So this really was him focusing right in on the nub of what was at stake here, Wimbledon. This was his 4th attempt at winning the greatest tournament.
His shoulder wasn't the best. He lost a couple of match points against Rafter. That famous image of him shaking at his arm.
And chasing down the ball that he'd won the previous point on. I remember once he didn't think that he'd been given the right ball and he frisked a ball boy vigorously and the ball fell out. And I think that was the match ball.
Yeah.
Wouldn't get away with that these days.
No, but that was a different time. If he hadn't won that match, he probably wouldn't be the magnanimous, relaxed Ivanišević we've seen in public since then.
He'd be homeless on the streets, shuffling along. And people would be pointing and saying, that's the man who lost 4 Wimbledon finals.
Yeah, sort of crossing the road before he came to them.
So thank God he won.
Well, thank God he won. Thank God she won. Who am I talking about, Remo?
Would have to be Jana Novotná.
Jana Novotná. Probably the most famous in a way. She lost... which Wimbledon was it, Remo?
93 and 97.
So 93 against Graf. Just to fill in our listeners here, the first set was won by Graf 7-6. And then she was up 6-1, 4-love. She went on a tear. She was playing out of her head. Like, it was beautiful tennis. And Graf later said she had no answer to it. And then Novotná hit a double fault. And everyone went, ooh, Novotná the choker, because she already had a bit of a reputation. And after that, Graf said she just saw a sliver of hope that she could get back in. Anyway, so Novotná lost that. She played Hingis a few years later in the final, when Hingis had that amazing breakout year.
I think just to backtrack, of course, in that 93 final is that touching scene where Jana Novotná was crying on the shoulder of the royal in attendance whose name escapes me.
I think it was the Duchess of Kent.
It was the Duchess of something. I think it was possibly Kent. And the world, I guess, just had a moment there. And one of those images that went around the world and which we all remembered. And, of course, the Duchess of Kent was there in 1998 to present the trophy to her.
She wasn't going to lose that one.
No.
The Duchess of Kent, who was a big supporter of her, I think they've actually struck up a bit of a friendship.
I wouldn't be surprised, yeah. Even though she broke every rule in the book by leaning her head on the royal's shoulder, and the consternation back up in the clubhouse was palpable.
Well, the Duchess of Kent took it very well. I mean, she did try to have Novotny's family deported after that. Other than that, she took it well. You've got to feel a bit sorry for Natalie Tozier, who never made another Grand Slam final.
Most people probably wouldn't recognise her in the street.
And sometimes she goes home for Christmas and her mother says, "Who are you?"
That's right.
And she has to pull out her credentials and her Wimbledon runner-up plate.
To get in the door and have a dinner.
And my mother said, "I asked you to bring a plate, but that's not what I wanted."
Marion Bartoli.
Bartoli or Bartoli? This is a really interesting one. She was coming to the end of her career.
Yes.
She'd never won a slam. She makes the final of Wimbledon and she's up against Sabine Lisicki. Now, Sabine Lisicki had knocked out Serena Williams in the quarters, I believe, and she was playing...
Beautiful tennis.
Beautiful tennis. They're calling her the new Steffi Graf, you remember? All expectations were that she would come out and just steamroll Bartoli. Bartoli was a very intense player and had some weapons, but the thought was, well, Lisicki had the biggest serve in tennis and that she would just steamroll her ground strokes were too good. It wasn't the case. Bartoli played the match of her life.
Yes.
Lisicki, it has to be said, walked out onto that court smiling in a way that sent shivers through me. And I remember thinking, she has lost this already.
Well, we've talked about this before, where you can pretty much call a match within a minute of the players taking the court just by looking at their eyes. With Andre Agassi against Sampras, where he comes out with that look of fear.
You know, like a rabbit in the headlights.
Yeah, I've seen it with Roger Federer, where it's almost a look of uncertainty. What am I doing here? Who are these people? What is this in my hand?
And it's only against Nadal.
And that day, it was almost as though there was a smile on her face. It was the smile of a hysterical woman trying to keep a lid on her emotions.
She said, Larry, she was incredibly nervous. This is Lisicki. And she burst down in tears in the second set or whatever. It was pretty awful to see. But Bartoli never lost her concentration.
Yeah. And I know we're talking about the winners, the one slam wonders. But after that match, that was pretty much it for Lisicki.
Yeah. She's not even in the top few hundred anymore. She has had injuries.
Yeah.
But she was never the same. Never the same after that. And she could have been anything.
Yeah. It just can happen.
And it's nice seeing Marion Bartoli around sometimes at the... they'll show her at different tournaments and she's very relaxed. She's a Wimbledon champion and no one can take it away from her.
No.
You know, not even the English from a French person.
And they've tried.
They've tried, God knows. A question for you, Rima. Are these wins sweeter than other wins? Are these wins when you've lost... Ivanisevic lost three Wimbledon finals. You reckon it's sweeter for him that he's won the last one?
Let me answer that question by putting this to you. Imagine this, 40 years from now, we're on two different porches in a retirement home. On one porch, we have Gaston Gaudiot, famous one slam winner of the French in 2004. On the other porch, we have Pete Sampras, holder of 14 Grand Slams. Men lost in the reverie on the porch that night. Maybe Gaudio's flicking away the empanada that he's had for dinner, while Sampras is still licking his lips from that corn dog he's devoured. Gaston Gaudio's mind goes through to those magical 2 weeks where he lit up Paris like a bomb Alaska, playing majestic, brilliant tennis, where he shone brilliantly. Sampras, his mind flits from the 94 US Open, the Australian Open in 97, Wimbledon 94, the streaker before the Krajicek Washington final. I don't know why that memory's in there, but Pete brings it up constantly. And he's thinking of all these. Now, who derives the most satisfaction? Gaston Gaudiot, thinking about that one brilliant moment in his life.
You know, you could be right.
That's the way I see it.
Sampras will always look at that and think, well, maybe I could have won more. Because that's the kind of guy he was. Gaudiot didn't expect to win that final. He walked out there laughing like a cavalier.
And he's still laughing every time he thinks of that.
Like a cavalier.
He'll be there, and what's Gaudiot laughing about? He's thinking about those 2 weeks in Paris.
Oh, yeah, there's Gaudiot laughing like a cavalier.
There'll be Pete Sampras gnashing his teeth, with his tongue hanging out. You remember the way his tongue used to hang out? We'll be doing a podcast on Sampras's tongue and its role in his greatness. That's another podcast. He'll be there thinking, I could have won this one, I could have won that one, and it's a blur. And I think, I don't know, I think there's something about this simplicity of winning that one.
Do you think that if Sampras, his Grand Slam tally had not been overtaken by 120 different people in the modern era, do you think that it would be different? If he still led the Grand Slam tally, do you think he'd sort of sit back and go, those were the days, and I feel very sated with what I've done. And now he's looking at it going, geez, I could have worked a bit harder.
Well, meanwhile, Gaston Gaudio is still laughing his ass off.
Breaking news. The world government today announced new regulations in regards to the Off the Frame tennis podcast. Our man in the field, Remo Shankar.
Thanks, Buzz. From midnight, it is illegal to subscribe or follow the Off the Frame podcast. You can now be prosecuted for simply pressing the follow or subscribe button.
Remo, does this extend to social media?
Watch the elbows, buddy. Anyone who follows Off the Frame on Twitter will automatically be fined $10,000. And that's US dollars, Buzz.
Incredible news, Remo. What's the feeling on the streets there?
I'm afraid it's threatening to bubble over here, Buzz. I have a local resident with me, Shorty Wells. What's your problem with the new rules?
Well, it's a freedom of speech issue, isn't it? You can't just go around passing legislation specific to one podcast, no matter how asinine or pathetic it is.
And what do you suggest the public does?
We don't want to resort to extreme measures. First, we want everyone to follow or subscribe to Off the Frame before midnight. Second, send an email to buzzandremo@gmail.com. And last, follow Off the Frame on Twitter.
And why are you wearing a badger costume?
What costume?
I'm Remo Shankar. Back to you, Buzz.
More news at 11.
And now three championship points for 21-year-old Andy Roddick, the number one junior in the world 3 years ago, on the verge of winning the U.S. Open. And he's done it! Grand Slam number one! 3 sets to love.
Heartbreak for Andy Roddick, who over 4 hours and 17 minutes and a record 77 games for a major final, pushed his opponent to the limit. Remarkably, the vanquished Roddick lost his serve only once in the entire match. Now, this is a contentious one, Buzz. Let's look at players who should have won more than one slam. My problem with this is, why should they have won more than one?
There could be multiple reasons. One, they won a slam and then injury took them. And so therefore, they had the ability to win more than one, but fate cruelly came in and ripped it from their grasp. There were those who had talent, but there's just someone in the era who has a lot more talent. So I'm thinking of Andy Roddick in that situation.
I agree with you on the injury. Where there's somebody who's more talented than them in the era that they play, that's just the way the cards are dealt. And we're talking about some great players here. We're talking about players like Roddick, Sabatini, Pat Cash, Michael Stick. Talented players, very talented players, who only won, and I say only, advisedly, one slam. But here's a question for you. Those players I just mentioned, imagine if they were all in a lift and the lift got stuck between floor one and floor two. Very symbolic. Does anybody in that group bring up the elephant in the lift, which could be why the lift has got stuck? But you know what I'm saying? Does it dawn on them? Do they all look at each other's faces? Does it hit them? Hey, we only won one slam each.
That they would recognise it immediately, or something that's ever present with
them.
They
pass each other in a hallway, in a cafeteria, a coded wave that one slam wonders give to each other.
And you think it's specific to one slam? It's like, you don't think, for example, that, say, Lendl and Connors look at each other and go, hey, eight slammer. You know, I don't think that would happen.
I can picture Lendl doing that. Not Jimmy.
Not Jimmy.
Because he wouldn't want to give Jimbo Lendl anything.
No.
They hated each other.
Exactly.
But yeah, that sort of thing. Is there like a camaraderie between players who acknowledge their sameness?
Look at some of these players. Okay, Cash. He made an Australian Open and then he won Wimbledon.
Mm.
And then he made another Australian Open.
Yes.
And then he ruptured his Achilles tendon in 1990.
Yeah.
That was pretty much the end of his career. Definitely. That was pretty much it. Now, would he have won more? Maybe not. Maybe the time had passed him. We don't know. But we do know that Roddick and Sabatini weren't facing that. They were just facing these greats they were playing.
That's right.
For Roddick, he won the US Open and then he lost four Grand Slam finals to Roger Federer. Four. Sabatini won the US in 90.
90 US against Graf.
And then she was up against Graf. And she also had to face Seles when she came through as well. Mm, so
yeah,
that was a tough road for both of them.
Mm.
Should they have won more? What do you think? Do you think Roddick should have won more?
I think Roddick got exactly what he deserved.
When he was playing great tennis, you could not pass him. You could not break his serve.
Couldn't get the ball around him. You couldn't get the ball over him. I admired his discipline, his work ethic on the court, off the court.
I'll tell you, Brian was one of the best serve and volleyer players that I had during my era, being that he was about 6'5". You could not pass Brian. He had such great reach in his game.
He played the Australian Open, and he just dominated it. Boy, I don't think he lost hardly a set. At that time, I thought he was one of the top five players in the world.
He's just a straight-up guy, solid individual.
He's a top-notch person. He's everyone loves Brian. And if you were in trouble, I'd call Brian. I really would.
So there we have some audio of other tennis players talking about Brian Teacher. Brian who, I hear you ask? Brian Teacher, who won the 1980 Australian Open final.
Honestly. I remember it well.
Now, the Australian Open has thrown up in the Open era some oddities. And one of the reasons for that was the tournament itself wasn't well respected. And so players didn't come down to play it.
Mm.
Borg came down once, for example. We're talking about a period in the 70s, early 80s, aren't we here?
Yeah, end of the 70s, early 80s. The tournament, look, I don't want to be unkind about the Australian Open, but as you alluded to, it was poorly organised and the level of interest in it was very low. If you look at some of the draws for the 1979, 1980 Australian Opens, there are players today who are still trying to enter those tournaments in the hope of cleaning up. They were awful.
Some players who were very good tennis players who made finals, they won their one Australian Open. Vitas Gerulaitis,
mm-hmm.
Roscoe Tanner.
Yes.
Guillermo Vilas won a US, didn't he? I think he won more
he
than one. Yeah, yeah.
He
so
did.
We're talking about Gerulaitis and Roscoe Tanner, who actually won it in the same year, 1977. Now, how did that happen, you might ask?
It was a scheduling mix-up.
Well, no, that's when the Australian Open went from... No, there was a... I don't understand why it was. Didn't
it was played in January,
yeah.
And then they decided to kick it again off in the future in December. I think there was something like that, where they played it in January and then they played it again in December.
Right. So you had two winners in 1 year, which is ludicrous.
Ridiculous.
And that just shows you how ridiculous the Australian Open was at that point.
They could basically do anything.
Now, the last Australian woman to win the Australian Open, Chris O'Neill,
yeah.
won it in 1978. Hi, Chris, if you're listening.
Hello, Chris.
Barbara Jordan won it in 1979. These are one slam wonders, by the way. We're not just talking about people who won the Open. We're talking about one slam wonders.
Yeah.
So Chris O'Neill, wow, what an achievement that was for her. I mean, she won in an Open. You can only play who's in front of you. That's the other side of it.
That's true. That's true.
And I've got a confession to make,
Remo,
and I'm a bit ashamed of this. For many, many years, I have been derogatory about Brian Teacher. And I feel a fool. And I'll tell you why. The reason I was derogatory about Brian Teacher.
Yeah.
1980 was a standout year for men's tennis. Let's face it. Bjorn Borg wins the French Open.
Mm.
Bjorn Borg wins Wimbledon against John McEnroe in one of the greatest finals ever. Bjorn Borg loses to John McEnroe in five sets in the US Open in a wonderful match.
Mm.
If Bjorn Borg wins that match, he comes to Australia to play for the Grand Slam. And everyone comes to try and stop him.
Oh, yeah.
But because Borg loses that fifth set, no one comes to the Australian Open, and Brian Teacher wins.
Do Do you know who Brian Teacher beat in the final?
Kim Warwick,
okay.
I think fairly handily he beat him. Now, the reason I'm ashamed of myself, one, from everything that's said about Brian Teacher, lovely guy, supportive guy. Not only that, really good tennis player. Mm. Not a Borg, not a McEnroe. Very few players are.
Yeah.
Excellent, excellent tennis player who had some really good victories in his career leading up to that.
Mm-hmm.
So he was no schlub.
No.
He's not some guy who just came in and...
From the club
and just won it. You know, he had some chops, as they say.
Yeah, yeah.
He never won anything again, basically. And I suspect injury may have crueled his later career.
Mm.
After tennis, he got ill, but he's also been a coach, he's been a trainer, he's been lauded in the US tennis system as being, you know, wonderful help to young players. He's also, I believe, the last Jewish man to win an Open.
Really?
Yeah, it's an interesting one.
Well, that is interesting. And we're coming up to 40 years since Brian Teacher won. Do you know if the Australian Open have invited him down to celebrate that milestone?
I think they should. Why not? Why not celebrate their history?
I'd love to see him sitting there next to Rod Laver at the final, wouldn't you?
Teacher and Laver. Laver and Teacher. It's like a multinational...
And how chuffed would Brian Teacher be?
Well, Australian Open...
I mean, Rod Laver wouldn't know who the guy was, but he's pretty convivial and genial. He'd take him in.
Yeah, exactly. Do you think the Australian Open, before it went to Melbourne Park in 87, was it? 80...
And they, you know, they built 88. They went to Flinders Park in 88.
Right. So they built that wonderful stadium and the Australian Open became this wonderful venue. Wonderful. I've got to say the word wonderful one more time. This wonderful venue for the players. They love coming down. Mm. Before that, it was a shambles. So do you think the Australian Open, there's a little part of them that wants to just sort of push that behind under the rug or not?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised because what was going on back then, it was awful. Like the players were transported there to the courts in rickshaws. It was just awful because they wouldn't fork out the taxis. They had to bring their own lunch to the courts. They were also playing the tournament in conjunction with patrons hiring the courts. So Teacher would finish his semi-final match and then a couple of ladies would come on and play some play some doubles.
Yeah, and he had to pay for his own court.
I'm with you. I think for years we derided people like Brian Teacher, and partly perhaps because we were ashamed of that part of our tennis history. But you know what? It wasn't Brian Teacher's fault.
No.
He came out and won a tournament.
He actually came down to Australia. It's a long trip in those days.
Well, that's right.
You know, he made the journey.
Yeah, he would have come, you know, cattle class on a plane. He wouldn't have been a man of wealth.
Of means, no.
No, and he did it. And I don't know how much the tournament was paying back in 1980, but I don't think he would have retired on it.
I think it was a slab of beer and, that was about it. I mean, do you remember the John Newcomb, Jimmy Connors 75 Australian Open?
Do I ever?
That's one of the more embarrassing things for Australians to look at, I believe, that final. I mean, much as we love John Newcomb, a wonderful tennis player, I've just used the word wonderful again. I just want to tag every time I use the word wonderful. Can you just pick me up on it?
I'll slap you every time you say that. That'll get it out of you.
That'd be wonderful. E-Y-A-O-T-A. Anyway, here's the Brian Teacher, mate. Cheers. Okay, Remo, I've got something for you. The last time. Now, I'm going to throw some things at you with the One Slam Wonders. Some of them are actually the last person to do something.
Wow. Okay.
In tennis. I'll throw one at you that we've already mentioned. Brian Teacher.
The last Jewish person to win a Grand Slam.
Exactly. Okay, here's one for you. In 1946... Yvonne Petra won his only Grand Slam, Wimbledon. There are two lasts for Yvonne Petra.
Two. Okay.
Two lasts.
I know one of them.
What do you think it is?
That he was the last player to win a Grand Slam wearing long pants.
He was. Very good.
And my question is, were the trousers from the House of Shingles?
Teddy would have loved to have designed some long pants for these players.
Oh,
God, can you imagine?
Well, could you imagine Teddy getting his hands on Yvonne Petra? He would have loved it.
Absolutely. There's Teddy Shingles we're talking about, of course, the great Teddy Shingles.
Yes.
Okay, he was the last Frenchman to win Wimbledon.
Really?
1946. Now, obviously, we talked about Marion Bartoli before.
But French man to win, wow.
I said Frenchman, you said French man. We said it differently.
Well, that is interesting. I would have sworn that between 1947 and the present day that another French person would have, another French man would have taken out the title at Wimbledon.
If you can name him, then I will be the first to stand up and applaud.
Wow, okay.
No. Cedric Pioline? No. He in the final against Sampras?
He was.
So we're talking about Wimbledon, of course. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about, obviously, Yannick Noah won the French.
Yes.
We're just talking about Wimbledon.
Okay.
Talking about Yannick Noah, we're playing the last time here. The last time! Yannick Noah won the 1983 French Open, and he was the last person to win a major.
Wearing dreadlocks? Using a wooden racket?
Absolutely.
No.
Yes.
Do you know what it was?
A wooden racket.
Okay. That's plenty of information. That's too much information.
I have no idea what
wow.
it was.
Wow. Really?
1983.
I would have guessed maybe McEnroe in 84, if you told me, but I believe you.
Wow, I better look at the record books.
No, I think McEnroe was using his Dunlop graphite by then. Oh, interesting.
Thank God, the last time stood up. So there you go, that's the last time.
I'm joined now by a great friend to this podcast, Teddy Shingles. Teddy, thank you for coming in at such short notice. Most appreciated to talk about one of our one slam wonders, Mark Edmondson, winner of the 1976 Australian Open against John Newcombe. He was remarkably ranked 212 at the time and pulled off an amazing victory to this day that stands as the last Australian player to win the local title.
John Newcombe was a heavy favourite. Mm. You can imagine nobody knew who Mark Edmondson was, this man with little feet coming onto the court. Mm. He did have little feet. Did you know that?
I've heard that for a very big, tall man, his feet were extremely small.
He took little steps. He was like a ballerina, but he moved beautifully on court for a man with little feet. But something happened that day that was quite unusual. Mm. As the game started, there was a decent wind. Mm. And you know in tennis it has an impact upon the match.
Of course.
It wasn't unmanageable, though. But as the match wore on, hats were flying across the court. A toupee hit me in the face and stuck there.
And is that an accepted protocol that if a toupee is blown off in somebody's face, that's when the umpire can legitimately call off a game?
Well, in those days, toupees weren't really attached as well as they are today.
Okay.
So it was more common than you would expect. So the umpire approached me in this break and said, Teddy, if there's some way that you can show me how strong the wind is, then perhaps we can actually get this match underway again. So I stood on the side near the net court judge, and I held up the toupee on a stick. Now, as the wind rose, it blew the toupee, but the toupee stuck to the stick. And the umpire could see if the toupee was pointing due north.
So it's like a windsock that you'd created, you'd fashioned.
It was like windwig.
Okay, I'd always wondered where that term came from, but thank you for explaining it.
Anyway, Newcombe was not happy. He didn't want to play the match in these conditions, or he didn't want to see me on the side with a toupee. He thought it was a comment on his uncle who wore a toupee, and I was shrugging my shoulders, but I had to keep my hand up in the air, and I said, Nuke, no, after the match, it was not a comment on your uncle, who's a lovely chap, and I know him well. But Nuke was put off, and Mark Edmondson rode that match to victory. With me standing on the edge, toupee on a stick in hand. I believe this is the only Grand Slam. In my own way, I'm a one-slam wonder.
Teddy, I've seen that match. And I have to say, possibly due to the camera angles or the way it was directed, I don't remember seeing you there. So you were possibly just always out of shot.
Well, I have to credit Richard, the umpire here, because in the break, he did go up to the director and the camera people and said, look, this is what's happening. I don't think we should show it. I don't think this would be really a good look for the Australian Open. I mean, I don't think anything could be worse in those days with the Australian Open, because it was a rabble, the whole place. It was
a
shambles.
No, you're very right. I think after that 76 Australian Open with you standing on the side with the toupee on the stick, it was all downhill from there for the next 3 or 4 years.
Well, and word got out, and I'm sorry to say this, but and you know I'm a great friend of Bjorn Borg, but he refused to come with me, a toupee and a stick, and I apologized to him, I begged him. I said, Bjorn, please come, Australians love you, and they did love him.
Teddy, any match involving John Newcombe, there usually is a party afterwards.
This is in the early disco era. John Newcombe rolled up to this party in a white suit. Mark Edmondson came up to me and he said, Teddy, I have a favour to ask for you. And I said, Mark, I don't like you, but I will. He said, do you know where I could source any char-grilled lamb?
Anyway, Teddy, thank you again for bringing us an insight that we would never have been privy to otherwise.
Can I just finish off by saying to John Newcombe, my relationship with him was strained on that day. Strained on that day. And it took us many, many years to repair our relationship. But I must say now he's a good friend and, as I said, underrated as a great Australian tennis player, as is Mark Edmondson.
Thank you, Teddy.
And God bless you. So we've come to the end of the podcast, and it's time to answer the teaser question that we announced at the start of the podcast. Mm-hmm. The question was, which of the four Grand Slams has produced the most solo winners in the Open era? I'm just shuffling through papers to make it sound as if it's more official here. Okay. And the winner is the French Open. Now, none of the other Opens come near it, except in the Australian Open with the men's. And we've talked about the Australian Open being an anomaly. And even with that anomaly, the French has thrown up more.
Yes.
Now, I believe you want to talk about why you think that is.
Well, I think it's interesting.
And with the French,
With the French, it obviously comes down to the surface. The thing that clay gives you, it's that one commodity on a tennis court that is precious, and that's time. When a great player takes apart another player, usually you'll hear comments like, they took my time away. On the slow grinding clay of Roland Garros, you have more opportunity to stay in the point. And I think a lot of players just need a little bit of time to get a sense of confidence, to feel secure in their strokes. And that's what can change a match often, where perhaps a champion won't always be able to put away a player ranked a good deal below. Do you know what I mean? I'm talking about...
No, I know exactly what you mean. And one thing interesting, when you look at all time, the French Open doesn't stick out as much as it does in the Open era. What is it about the Open era, do you think, that has created that discrepancy?
Well, previously, it was much more about two surfaces. It was grass and clay. That was pretty much it.
You think in that period, it was more competitive on clay?
I believe so.
Yeah, that would make sense.
But the whole thing with the clay is that it prevents players from being overwhelmed more so. It helps them settle. They get a chance to restore some self-belief. They get that time.
Yeah.
And I think that's the key to it.
Anyway, there you go. So the French Open. If you answered French Open, then you have won absolutely nothing because we've got nothing to give you. And that's about it from us. So good evening, good night, good morning, wherever you are.
I couldn't add another thing to that.